Welcome to Tales of Northern Michigan's Past. I'm your host, Christopher Struble. Two or three seasons ago, we visited Big Bay, Michigan, located just miles north of Marquette on the shores of Lake Superior. The once booming industrial lumbering town from the 1880s achieved international recognition in 1959 with the release of the movie Anatomy of a Murder, a thinly veiled fictional quote-unquote film based on a novel by John Volker, who was the defense attorney in the real-life precedent-setting trial of the murder of bartender Morris Chenoweth by Army Lieutenant Coleman Peterson in 1952 in Big Bay, which was the inspiration for the book and movie. Volker wrote this book under the pen name of Robert Travers and received a bit of backlash from the relatives of Chenoweth because of it so closely followed the factual events of the murder and trial. The majority of the film was shot on location in and around Big Bay, which was very uncommon at the time. More about Anatomy of a Murder a bit later. Big Bay also boasts one of the only lighthouses around the Great Lakes that are also operational as B&Bs. The town is steeped in history, a small town in a very remote location that for decades supplied the rest of the country with resources that contributed to the cultural and industrial progression from frontier to industrial leader, for better or worse. Looking around on a lazy day in March, when I last visited, it's hard to imagine the history that is represented only by the few establishments and structures still standing from the long gone days. An online site about Big Bay states that the first known person to settle in the area was a man called Morris LeClaire. His actual date of arrival, however, is not known. By the 1880s, LeClaire was joined by Charles Burns, a Scot lumberman and fisherman. Around 1903, the owners of the Brunswick Lumber Company, founded in Cincinnati in 1845, were known as the top manufacturers of what were considered to be the finest billiards tables, among other products. They sent their sons and nephews and family members to northern Michigan in search of maple and oak, and soon expanded their operations and built a sawmill on the shores of Big Bay. It is estimated 90% of the bowling pins in the world at that time were made by Brunswick, the majority of which were manufactured in the Big Bay facility. They also made car tires, record players, and bars. If you've ever visited City Park Grill in downtown Petoskey, you probably noticed a spectacular bar built by Brunswick Company. It was very much a company town, with Brunswick owning the local store and employing the majority of the 1,000 residents the town estimated to have had at its peak. By 1932, sadly, the Brunswick Company closed its doors. Next chapter, Henry Ford loved Michigan's Upper Peninsula, the rustic beauty, climate, and solitude it offered. He, Harvey Firestone, and Thomas Edison, his mentor, made annual visits to the area from 1916 until 1924 in a specially built vehicle that was way ahead of its time. Its design allowed him to travel throughout the rustic wilderness with his friends while enjoying the finest gourmet meals and very, very comfortable sleeping accommodations. Ford also at this time began to be consumed by a lifelong quest to become entirely self-sufficient and not reliant on others. Ford was so obsessed with his goal of becoming non-reliant on others that he purchased large parcels of land in South America so he could even produce his own tires, which would have effectively destroyed his friend Harvey Firestone's business if his plan had succeeded. He was well aware that the area he loved also held vast amounts of virgin forest, which at that time still abounded northern Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and he began purchasing property, and I mean lots of property. Soon, he and Ford Motor Company owned at least 310,000 acres of forest in northern Michigan's Upper Peninsula. He opened sawmills in many towns, including Lance, Alberta, and Iron Mountain, among others. The wood was used in the manufacturing of steering wheels, wood paneling, and in the early years, actually wood wheels. While traveling on business trips, he was often accompanied by his wife, Clara, who had a mutual appreciation of the northern wilderness. On one such trip in 1943, he discovered the old Brunswick factory town in Big Bay. This time, he not only purchased the old mill and power plant, but almost every other building in town. One of the buildings Ford purchased was an old company store built in 1909. Soon after, Ford and Clara began to transform the old market into a well-appointed hotel for executives of his company and for Clara to offer a retreat for participants and her many philanthropic endeavors, including the medical hospital. Welcoming us today is Mark Bevins. Mark and his wife, Sue, have owned the historic inn since 2021. And I was fortunate enough to have a gracious tour with my family earlier in March, and Mark took us through the whole building, and I was completely blown away and asked him if we could have him join us for an interview. So owner of the Thunder Bay Lodge in Big Bay, Michigan, is Mark Bevins. Welcome, Mark.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Well, we had a couple little technical things, but we're good now, right? Mark, what drew you to Big Bay in such an undertaking? I mean, that building dates back quite a while, so it must have been a labor of love.
Certainly was. So my father, who was a research engineer for Ford Motor Company down in Dearborn, started commuting here to hunt and fish in 1956. That happened to be the same year that I was born. So my first trip up to Big Bay was in my mother's womb. And we have been commuting here four times a year during my entire natural life. And I like to explain to people, he was so passionate that I didn't get to go to Maine, or I should say our family, didn't get to go to Yellowstone, didn't even get to go to Mackinac Island as a kid because we were too busy commuting to Big Bay.
Four times a year.
Summer, spring, fall, and winter. Actually, all of them. Spring to steelhead fish, summer to camp with the family. I used to think that he loved taking us on hikes. Now, in hindsight, I can see he was scouting for deer areas. The fall, of course, to hunt. And the winter, more so me coming up here and doing a lot of mountain camping and hiking. I do have to tell you, for a first third of my life, I thought that I was cursed. And after I grew up a little bit in young adulthood, I realized what a blessing it was to be brought up here.
I can identify with that. My first trip to Gaylord, Michigan, on a private lake way out in the middle of the woods, was with my mom's womb, and then I summered every year, and it was looking back on it, those were idyllic years for sure.
Yeah, and most people that come and stay, like yourself, have had that same experience—a grandfather or family camp somewhere, or cottage—and and they're getting back to their roots and all that's natural, if you will.
What was Big Bay like when you first started? Kind of like your first memories. What was it like during those years?
Because it's gone. Yeah, the first years. It's a good question. The first years that I recall, 9, 10, 11, is when I was independent enough to be able to leave Perkins Park there and cruise around and explore. Wasn't much different than it is today, actually. And that's what was really cool about it was kind of like an India Mayberry RFD quaint little town. There was a couple of group of kids my age, and we became friends, actually lifetime friends. And it was a place where you could roam just about anywhere, and as long as you were back by what my mom used to call dark 30, everything was good. And of course, we didn't have cell phone tethers or anything.
Tether's the right word. So, that is a tether.
Oh yeah. So we got to bang around and discover a whole bunch of stuff, and no one fell off a cliff, thank God.
Oh, God.
Or got hurt too bad, or got mauled by a bear, which we were worried about when we were kids. So it was cool. And then it was later on as a young adult and this is about 30 years ago, that this place came up for sale, and I did a tour and actually a engineering report for a bank. And I thought I had a good shot at purchasing it, but I got outbid. But there was something about this place that's always been in my plans. And most people that I associated with the last 35 years have heard stories and dreams of me getting into this role here.
What condition was the building in when you took control of it?
In 21, Way back when, or in 21?
Well, let's say, how was it when you were like as a kid, and then how did it change, you know, over the years before you purchased it? Did it was there ups and downs? I mean, we're going to get into the older history here soon, but like during the, you know, I guess current in a sense, between the years when you first encountered the building, and then was it being used as an inn at that time? And then what condition was it in, like when you just decided you were gonna purchase it?
Yeah. After Henry Ford converted it, and I think we're going to get into that later in the conversation, in 43, it had been used as an inn off and on. There were several groups that purchased and ran it, and the economies would drive the tourism to a snail's pace, and inevitably they would end up losing it. It is quite a big building, and you need, you know, tourist commerce to sustain it. But as a kid, I don't recall other than the monument. And as a young adult, and then a middle adult, bringing my kids, because we emulate exactly what I did as a kid. We raised our kids here 4 times a year. And when we got, as I recall as an adult, it was a restaurant, and I never did do a lot of exploring inside. I never stayed here. I was a camper, and we came here, obviously, for the wilderness adventure. But I don't really recall it changing, to answer your question directly, very much from the outside as it relates to driving around and being in the neighborhood and et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The place is in immaculate shape. I mean, I love old buildings. I travel, I just seek out old hotels. We have several here in the Petoskey area. There's other places in the UP that I've ventured to, numerous places, but I don't think that place was in any better or finer condition when Henry Ford owned it. You had that place. I mean, it's like a modern retro throwback to what it was back in the day. It's absolutely immaculate inside there.
Yeah, we're getting there. And you bring up a really good point. When I did the review for the bank, the technical review, it wasn't a financial estimate. It was a structural. We had discovered back then that the 32-inch Lake Superior sandstone foundation that dives a couple 6 feet below the foot-and-a-half concrete floor, and the building is 45 by 125, and then divided in thirds long ways by, supported by each floor by 15 by 18 red oak beams, and then 2 by 14 floor joists with 2 inches of fir on the first floor and trimmed out on the second, which constitutes 28 inches of floor support. We discovered that they had overbuilt this ginormous company store. And the truth is, it hasn't moved a quarter inch in 117 years now. So that's what attracted me. And we are in the process, as you duly noted, of restoring what we can, theming the main room after Brunswick, what we call the lobby now, because they built the town. And Henry Ford upstairs, because he converted the storerooms into in-rooms, which makes for quite an ambiance. And I will say, I tell people that between Brunswick, Ford, and Preminger, this place, the historical ambiance is like a 150-year-old bottle of scotch. You just can't make it up. It just has to occur. And it has arrived, and that's our inspiration for theming and showcasing it, is to share that heritage with all the local folks and good folks that come along that are interested in the history.
Well, and that's the funny thing is, during the intro, I mentioned, you know, I guess there's a couple of different eras for Big Bay. Anatomy of a Murder was, we did an episode a couple of years ago on Anatomy of a Murder, and I think you were closed that day, so we went to the inn there. I never made it inside. This was my first time inside of your establishment. We went to the bar, I guess. You're the inn. So that was great. And just having a great tour that day of of the building. And that's one thing I did notice also is that we talked about it. The building's built like a fortress. But you kind of have three eras, if I'm not mistaken, as I kind of was researching, you know, Big Bay. We've got, of course, the lumbering, and then you got kind of the Brunswick era, the Ford era, and then, of course, the things that you're doing up there right now. The Brunswick Company was founded in Cincinnati in 1845. Is that correct?
Correct. Brunswick was a wood craftsman, Jewish Swedish that came to America in 1834, and he fashioned himself making motorless carriages. But he ended up in Cincinnati making bowling pins, bowling alleys, bowling balls out of maple, and pool tables, and very ornate, which you can find globally, I don't know what they call them, the bars and the backdrops. I'm not sure what the name is, but it's called, proper name. So he sent a nephew of Moses Bensinger, Jay Deutsch, and a son-in-law, Moses Bensinger was, son-in-law to Brunswick. And they came up to Marquette, and they met a couple guys named Brown and Schneider. And they were in some small level logging, and they contracted them to come up here and survey and report back the oak and the maple density of the forest here. And so when they came back, they said they reported it was the greatest stand of maple and oak in the world. And of course they would. They were local guys selling their local area. But that inspired Mr. Brunswick to buy 12,000 acres and create the Lake Independence or Independence Lumber Company, which constituted 100 logging camps, this company store, a hotel, the mill, and basically post-industrial steam engine era, the town of Big Bay.
And that's something to mention too. The building started out as a company store.
Correct, a mini mall for 10 logging camps.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's said that Brunswick's putting out about 90% of the bowling pins in the world at this point.
Correct. And, I should have mentioned, and I didn't, the business paradigm for Brunswick in that post-steam industrial era was he ran little British steam engines, they call them Limeys, to 10 logging camps via railroad. Basically, it was a big spur in the area. And that was a big paradigm shift in that they were able to take flatbeds with big booms out in the woods, load the logs up and bring them back to camp as opposed to pulling them with the big single axle, big wheeled skidders and or ice sleds, ice and river sleds. So that was a big deal back in that day, that paradigm.
Where is Lake Independence in relation to that downtown, you know, the main center square, I guess, of Big Bay?
Yeah, Lake Independence used to be a jetty of sort that the Yellow Dog River and the Johnson and Alder Creek would flow into. And then when the big logging operation came here, originally they had a wooden dam on what they call the Iron River. That would be the output or the exit of Lake Independence. And they raised the lake level a couple, 3 feet. I don't know exact dimensions, but it allowed them to float logs in prior to the hot ponds. And basically, that's just processing them so they were clean enough to go in the mill. But they did create the lake level to go up, and that's evidenced over on the south end where when it rose, there was low forest over there that turned into what they call the stumps today.
Hmm.
But the lake got bigger because of the logging operations at the mill.
What Brunswick comes to Michigan like around 1906. You said family members were looking for oak and maple, and then they opened.
Go ahead.
Then they expanded their facilities to northern Michigan and built quite a big factory up there, and it pretty much became a company town. Is that correct?
100%. That's all it was. They had a silent movie house. They had what we refer to this building as is a mini mall for 10 logging camps, meaning they supplied everything that employees or the mill or the camps needed. And there was a big processing house here, and we don't have a lot of history on it, but it was every much as big as this company store, and they processed a lot of meat and vegetables and stuff. Still working on that history. But yeah, it was a company town and is highlighted by the fact that every street is named after a Brunswick executive or a relative.
Is that right? And but now Brunswick doesn't last that long up there, right? It was a relatively short period as far as you know how much money they had invested. When did they close down the facility?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So Jay Deutsch was running the operations here, and Mr. Deutsch had a big mansion on the cliffs here north of town, and he had went over to. So these guys were pretty big operation, and he ended up going over to an island on southwest of France and acquiring a herd of Guernsey cows. And with that purchase came a little British herdmaster. So Deutsch was up there doing his cow herding and running the mill and the company store, basically the whole town. And leading up to the Depression, of course, things started getting, the wheels started coming off the economy, and it hit this place really hard, of course.
Sure.
And he went to a gentleman by the name of Louis Kaufman. Mr. Kaufman is credited, he's a local guy that was a banker here in Marquette, started out, but he was credited with creating franchise banking. And what that means is he went to the federal government and got the laws changed and created the concept of franchise banking. And so he spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. and New York. In fact, he's also credited with financing one of four guys that financed Empire State Building, so you can see the magnitude
in that
description.
Yeah.
So anyhow, getting back to Deutsch, he, as he was losing his shirt, he went to Mr. Kaufman and said, can you lend me some money and float me through this? It was leading up to the Depression. And Kaufman looked at his books and told him that he didn't feel like he had a good enough business case, and with the uncertainty, he didn't feel like he could lend them the money, but he knew of the Guernsey cattle. And apparently they made an agreement that Deutsch would put that up as collateral. And then a year or two later, I don't know exact time, he lost everything, just like Mr. Kaufman thought he would. And Kaufman took the cattle and built a big barn up there, Loma Farms, and it had 3-inch cork floors and ornate Dutch tiles and all the stalls. It was really a fascinating story. Anyhow, at that point, Mr. Deutsch donates his cattle farm to the Baycliff, which is what it is today, to a couple nurses, one of which Catholic nurses was Miss Morse. I don't recall the other name. And it's been run as a handicap facility ever since. It's quite the goodwill example of goodwill, as good as anywhere on earth right now. So they take handicap folks that apply and come up there and afford them a camp experience that they would never get probably in a lot of other environments. Meanwhile, Mr. Deutsch back in the day. We don't know historically where he went. We believe he stayed in and around Marquette County, but that's part of the history that we haven't cultivated yet. Doing a lot of communication with the Muskegon History Museum, and I've just recently got a book about the Brunswick family. So still a lot more to research there and understand as it relates to Mr. Deutsch. But after the Depression, carrying him and logging company from Grayling bought the facility, and they and that means the whole town, and they employed all the loggers. They ran the mill, and they made maple and oak flooring up to the point that they sold it to Henry Ford in 42 and 43.
So Brunswick at this time, are they completely done?
They were done. They were kaput in Big Bay, yes.
It's, but still, the other facilities were still manufacturing it to some extent.
Yeah, they altered it to flooring. I guess I do want to tell you that it's very interesting that Kaufman, Louis Kaufman, he was contacted by a gentleman named... God, I got to think of it. Willie Durant. Mm-hmm. Willie Durant created General Motors in the early days. And when Durant got basically thrown out, I don't know if that's the right expression to use these days, but for some reason he was unseated running General Motors. He went to Kaufman and he said, I got a couple young gentlemen I want to finance in automotive. And would you lend me the money? And he did. And the two gentlemen were the Chevrolet brothers. And they, of course, became second only to Ford Motor Company back in the early days. They reinstalled Willie Durant to the board. And then they appointed Mr. Kaufman to be part of the financial board. And, you know, General Motors financial arm or leg of the company was in New York City until 2005 or 6 or 7. But that's interesting because they had considered building a plant up here, automotive plant in the Marquette County area. But from our research to date, they did make Buick parts. And I'm talking about Mr. Deutsch and the Brunswick Company actually made wooden Buick parts there for a while, which we thought was pretty fascinating. You know, I retired from General Motors, so I find the connection there is quite intriguing.
This is Tales of Northern Michigan's Past with Christopher Struble. Tune in next time as Chris continues his conversation with Mark and Sue Bevins, the owners of the Thunder Bay Inn.